Welcome to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. This program is produced in association with KQED Public Radio and the Aspen Institute. I'm Jane Wales, your host. While globalization has lifted millions from poverty, the forces that drove it have largely left the middle class behind. There's a growing sense that the social contract is now broken. This week and for the following 2 weeks, we'll be featuring a three-part series on the rebuilding of the social contract from three different perspectives: that of the people, that of the business sector, and that of government. This is the first episode, and it's taken from the people's perspective. We'll ask what forces caused the breakdown of the social contract and what citizens can do to rebuild it. Joining us in this discussion is Tom Nichols. He's professor at the Naval War College. And Ian Bremmer. He's president and founder of the Eurasia Group and of G-Zero Media. Moderating the program is my co-host, Ray Suarez. This broadcast is made possible each week with the generous support of Chevron, VMware, and the Draper Richards Kaplan Foundation. And now to Ray Suarez.
Ian Bremmer and Tom Nichols, welcome. Though they may not use the same language, they may not use the same terms for it, the set of variables that people from Paris to Istanbul to Sao Paulo to Ohio describe sounds like breaking the social contract. Ian Bremmer, let's start with you. What happened?
I think a lot of people feel like the system is rigged against them. A lot of people feel like the leaders that have legitimacy, the elites, the intellectuals, the wealthy, whether we're talking about CEOs and bankers or the mainstream media and public intellectuals, and of course political leaders, that large numbers of members of the populations of all of these democracies, wealthy and not so wealthy around the world, feel like those people, those elites, have forgotten about them, and that the system is not working for them. And as a consequence, they're increasingly susceptible to messages of people that promise to break the existing system, either constructively or destructively.
Tom Nichols, will you buy that definition of our recent era?
I think Ian's right in his description of what's happening in terms of how people perceive it. But I always question the notion that the system is rigged, in the sense that first, I think social resentment is just built into human society because we are not all equal all the time. And also this sense that the system isn't working for them. I find it difficult to accept that in a society where even the poorest people are living longer, healthier, and more affluent lives and surrounded by technology and conveniences and other aspects of their life that are so woven into the world around them that they've really kind of ceased to notice it. And what they're really concentrating on is a kind of more vague cultural resentment that I'm not sure there's any cure for other than the passage of time.
I get what you're saying about rising material wealth, but this feeling, and that's fairly widespread, and you hear it expressed in various ways all around the world, that we've been lied to, that people didn't tell us the truth. Is that a reasonable reaction from rank-and-file citizens of various countries to the messages they got from the elites in the modern era? Tom Nichols.
I guess I would ask, lied to about what? Part of what I see in the 21st century, and I think there is a problem. I think that there is a decline in the durability of the social contract, but in part, I think it's because of 40 or 50 years of people getting what they want, which is ever cheaper conveniences and products and goods and services. Now, I suppose you could say that, and I think there's truth to the charge, that the elites who benefited from globalization argued that the benefits would be more broadly distributed than they've been. That, I think, is a perfectly legitimate criticism to make. But somehow this notion that all of the elites around the world lied to the working folks about how great the 21st century would be, I think, to me, is, again, a kind of cultural resentment. The challenge I would make here is for the people who are disturbed about this and the people that are protesting this. If all of the elites of the world were to surrender tomorrow, the question I would have is, okay, you win. What do you want? What is it that you want them to do now? And usually the answer is, I just want a lot of income redistributed. But I don't think that solves the problem. And I don't think that scratches the itch of resentment that these folks are feeling.
I want to talk more and in greater depth about solutions later in the program, and we will get to that. But at first, let's continue with our diagnoses. Ian Bremmer, they got what they wanted. You hear Tom Nichols saying that by focusing on elite choices rather than talking about what the great masses of people everywhere around the planet have been asking for is making a mistake.
Look, I think we both agree, Tom and I, that there is a very widespread and agreed perception that the social contract and the system is not working for these people. The question, the difference that we have is what percentage of that, how much of that is legitimate, and how much of it is being driven by technology, the filter bubble, social media with business models for corporations that are driving people crazy by only listening to other people with the same grievances and people that are profiting from, you know, politically exploiting that sense of grievance. I accept that some piece of the upset comes from that, comes from this new group of technologies that actually undermines the fabric, rips apart the fabric of civil society in democracies today, while making a country and a leadership like China actually stronger by directing behaviors and giving them the data and the surveillance to keep the people in check. I get it. But I'm not prepared to say it's 50-50. Right. I do believe that these grievances are real. And I want to make clear that in part of it's economic. Part of it is that we have greater economic inequality in the United States right now than at any point since the Great Depression. And that has happened in part because the extraordinary wealth that has been generated by the U.S. and by the corporations and by the shareholders, we haven't seen a lot of redistribution. We haven't seen investments into the kind of infrastructure that would be needed to improve the educational system for people that are otherwise left behind, for ensuring that they have access to the kinds of health care that would allow them to live fulfilled long lives. That, you know, all of those things, and I we can't let that go. But we also can't let go the fact that this isn't just about the government we're talking here. I mean, think about Varsity Blues. You've got a lot of Americans that feel like the system is rigged, that wealthy parents will do everything possible to make sure that their kids, no matter how smart they are, have access to the kinds of education that will allow them to continue to be part of the elite. The system is rigged. I was stunned to see that in Greenwich, Connecticut, over 50% of high school students from Greenwich were using letters from psychologists that were allowing them to take SATs, not in 4 hours, but untimed over 2 days because they had psychological issues. That was made up, it was BS, and it was absolutely a part. And everyone in the middle class and the underclass saw that news and said, yep, we knew it. It's yet one more way that people that have access to power are keeping themselves in behind the gates, and they're keeping us out. And it's the fact that people with access to gatekeepers are doing everything they can to facilitate their kids' lives while not actually caring about what's happening to people on the other side of the gates. And I think that sense of anger is one that is deeply legitimate. It's one that has come from a system where money plays far too great a role in the ability to create rules that benefit you and don't benefit people that don't have. And that's really kind of anti-American. It does not create equality of opportunity in this country. It's meant that how you do as a child is really very dependent on how wealthy and how connected your parents are. That's not the way the American dream was supposed to work.
Tom, you heard Ian describe two trends that are, in a lot of people's perception, interconnected. Not only the vastly larger share of every new dollar in the economy that the top 1% or the top 10% takes, but that they're also walling themselves off, creating a new class that doesn't have to worry about competition from the lower orders. And we see that in the slowing of social mobility. If you grow up in the poorest quintile of the American population, you are more likely to stay there. Even if you grow up in the middle fifth, the third quintile, you're less likely to spend any time in the top two than you were earlier in the American century, let's say.
Well, a couple of things. I think Ian has phrased it quite accurately that, you know, he and I agree that there is some kind of shared responsibility. What we don't agree on is the relative burden on this. And I think that's, you know, I think neither Ian nor I are denying the role of elites or of the behavior of the masses in this problem. The question we both ask, and I think that we've both debated, is you know, which came first, which is making the problem worse. There's a couple of things that Ian brought up, though, that I think that are really important. You know, for one, I think it's almost like everything old is new again. We're discovering that rich people try to build in advantages for their children and that they don't care very much about poor people. Well, you know, this is something I think we all knew already. What's different now, I think, is that, first of all, again, through these technologies, we're confronted with it much more directly. And in a positive way, I think actually through accountability. I mean, something like Varsity Blues would never have been outed 30 years ago. I mean, Varsity Blues, you know, 30 years ago was just how things worked with rich people buying libraries or pretending their kids are athletes. I think what's really striking about Varsity Blues is just how kind of grungy and petty that was. This wasn't, you know, the elite North Shore families or Beacon Hill buying their children into Harvard after six generations. This is an actress paying $500,000 to get somebody into USC, which, you know, really, I think that does strike the public in a different way, because while the public doesn't expect to go to Harvard, they do kind of expect to be able to go to a place like USC. And I think that's where it hurts more, to say even in the places we're supposed to be able to compete, we get priced out by people who have just crazy amounts of money. But, you know, when Ian was talking about the psychologists in Greenwich, again, everything has an unintended consequence. A lot of conservatives have never forgiven George Bush 41 for the Americans with Disabilities Act, which was meant to be empathetic and to account for people and to help them with disabilities. And, you know, people gamed that system. But a lot of folks out there warned that you were going to get this kind of behavior because it incentivized this kind of behavior. And it's not that big of a surprise to find out that people are gaming a system when the government is encouraging them to do it. I also take issue with the notion that somehow things are worse in terms of infrastructure and investment. I mean, there are, yes, in some quantitative sense, bridges are falling down and we need to fix them. But having lived through the 1970s, what I really find striking about this, I mean, if you had asked me when America really felt like it was coming apart, cities and towns were just literally crumbling around us, I would have identified the late 1970s and not the 2010s. And one of the things I think is really interesting in this debate, we are not spending a lot of time talking about the very poorest people. These really aren't the complaints of people that are living in Appalachia who don't have running water, of people in Flint who have poisoned water. I mean, this is really a dialogue between the elites and a kind of rising middle class that just isn't living the life it thinks it should be living. And Ian used the expression fulfilled lives. The elites cannot change the rules of the game to give you a fulfilled life. The elites cannot make you more feel more spiritually enriched or closer to your family. And when I start thinking about the, Ray, you brought up how people, you know, in the poorest and even the third quintiles kind of stay where they are, that's when I want to start pointing to things like out-of-wedlock births, which, you know, white working class out of wedlock births are where they they're now where they were among black families in the 1960s when Daniel Patrick Moynihan pushed the panic button back in 1965. Drug addiction, alcoholism, persistent joblessness. These were all problems that a lot of people cared a lot less about when these were problems of the black inner city. And now what we're finding is these are problems of the white working class, and suddenly it's a national crisis. And I find a certain, I'm not talking about Ian here, but I'm finding in some of the people that are out there agitating about this, I'm finding a certain amount of hypocrisy in this, that suddenly when we have a lot of white working class guys taking opioids, again, in part because of the way disability rules incentivize treatment for things like this. It's a crisis. When the cities were imploding and melting down like a core meltdown in a nuclear plant, there was a lot less concern about it and about the social contract. And I think some of this is being driven by the accessibility of communication. Again, maybe this is Ian's point about technology, that this particular class of people who have access to more communication in a way that the really very poorest people do not is privileging their complaints, which are really much closer to the middle class than to the really abject poor. So I'm skeptical about this collapse of society because I feel like it's being driven by a very strong sense of relative deprivation by people who are not nearly as poor as that poorest quintile.
Ian Bremmer?
Look, Tom is completely right that there's a lot of hypocrisy. There's no question that when these issues were hitting black inner city youth, we didn't care very much. I mean, when you had, sort of a massive heroin issue and it was largely about people that didn't look like us, it wasn't driving a lot of attention. Gang violence, sort of in South Central LA, same kind of thing, right? And that's also true with refugees. We got 3 million refugees from Venezuela right now in Colombia. We don't care. We don't worry about it. But God forbid you've got some Syrians actually showing up in Europe, in white Europe, and suddenly we pay a lot of attention. That's true. And that's the human condition. It's unfortunate, and we can point out the hypocrisy. But we can't suddenly say that's what's driving all of this. We have to recognize that the role of money and special interests in government in the United States from the 1970s to today has grown exponentially. And the ability of those special interests on the left and on the right of the political spectrum to capture the regulatory process in ways that are very useful for them and very bad for the average American. And we see this playing out right now with social media. I mean, the fact is that the American government doesn't have the ability, the wherewithal or the ability, the knowledge to, play nanny state and actually force companies that have business models that are bad for Americans and driving Americans apart to actually bring them together. Don't have the ability to put a warning label on the side of a Facebook app saying use of this application as intended will be dangerous to your mental and emotional health. It is exactly the same as what the big food companies were doing in the 70s and 80s and 90s, and they weren't properly regulated. They ensured that we have as much access as possible to salt and fat and sweet, and we end up in America with the highest level of type 2 diabetes and obesity in the world, on the planet. Now, you can absolutely say that part of that is the responsibility of the average human being to push away that last slice of Pizza Hut. I get you. But I also think that if the companies are driving the regulations, if they're writing their own regulations, they are going to be incredibly powerful. And they'll ensure that, the products that are being seen in the supermarkets that are easiest to grab and easiest for your kids to grab are the ones that are bad for you but have the high profit margin. And that's exactly what Facebook and Twitter and YouTube are doing to us today. And the role of money in government, the role of money in campaigns, the role of the special interest lobbies in the legislative compartment, all of those things are driving this. You can't just say, oh, it's the new technologies and not take a step backwards and recognize it's because the American system is increasingly bought and paid for.
Tom, a few minutes ago, you were talking about the symmetries emerging between the white working class of today and the inner city urban poor of the 60s. And you were talking about drug addiction and so on. But, you know, there's something else that those two groups of men, largely men, have in common, and that's a tremendous despair. Deindustrialization came before the heroin crisis in places like Harlem and the South Bronx and the South Side of Chicago. And the same kind of despair is being identified today in the Youngstowns and the Zanesvilles and the Cantons and the Akrons. Angus Dayton, in his recent research, was talking about this epidemic of despair. And isn't that something that these two very different groups of men, these 1960s minority men in formerly industrialized center cities, and these white working class men in a range of places in America today, have in common?
Well, I want to point out two things. One is a paradox that Ian has raised, and the other is a historical disconnect that you've raised. The paradox that Ian talks about, where, you know, people are going to eat themselves into diabetes and drink sugary drinks and live, you know, if it's put out there and it's unhealthy, people will do it. You know, I'm kind of okay with a more paternalistic state that says, don't spend all day on Facebook. Don't smoke these cigarettes because they will cause cancer. Drinking to excess will kill you. I'm fine with all of that, but you have to square that with the problem that the populists who are in the street are railing against elitists who they think are telling them what to do. And the problem in dealing with those people is you can't have it both ways, because in effect, what you're left dealing with are people who are out there saying, stop giving me everything I want. You know I'm eating myself to death, but don't tell me what I can eat and what I can't eat. Get government off my back. Get the elites, you know, to stop haranguing me and telling me how to live my life. Well, you know, okay, you win. I'm going to stop telling you how to live your life, but you are going to end up, you know, if you eat it, you know, if you eat pizza and hamburgers three times a day, you know, you're going to get sick. And I don't know how to square that paradox, because the same people who want the elites off their back are the people that I think Ian and I would both agree need to be guided away from self-destructive choices. The thing you brought up about history and deindustrialization and despair, you know, people forget, you know, if you really, that it's like we keep reliving, it's like Groundhog Day. We keep reliving this self-mortification over deindustrialization. I come from a deindustrialized city in Massachusetts. We grew up at opposite ends of the state, but about the same time, both of our cities kind of imploded under the weight of deindustrialization. I can tell you, having worked in state government in Massachusetts back in the day, deindustrialization where I lived was pretty much a completed fact almost 40 years ago. And so we, you know, again, we keep, well, every time someone has this complaint about the elites, they say, well, it's because of deindustrialization. Well, you can't keep closing the same factory 10 times. The factories that are closed in my hometown closed 40 years ago, and they didn't reopen. There are people marching in the streets complaining or going to rallies and complaining about deindustrialization when that happened before they were actually born. You know, go listen to John Cougar Mellencamp or Bruce Springsteen albums from the early 1980s, and it's all about the windows being boarded up and the empty farms and the foreclosures and the collapse and the factories being empty. We dredge up this myth of a happy industrial past that most people didn't experience, and frankly, I think both Ian and I would agree, having walked across a factory floor, most people today would not want to live or work in that environment. And yet we keep idealizing it as a way to say that somehow the elites screwed me over.
But I'm deeply offended you didn't bring up Billy Joel there. I mean, you know, come on. You can't just go with
yes,
John
and,
Cougar.
Right, that's Allentown. Not,
right, right, yeah.
I grew up around empty factories and warehouses in Brooklyn. And, you know, there's a lot of similarities, yet here we are, three guys who got educations, no longer are part of those places that we were formed by, and I think can see clearly enough to see that different Americans identify different villains when asked about the same set of variables. Isn't it fair to note that that if you're in one political orientation, you might identify globalization as the problem, whether it is or not? And if you're somewhere else along the spectrum, you might identify immigration as the problem, whether it is or not. That we are down in that middle class place you were talking about, Tom, where we're feeling a lot of the same things, but identify or diagnose the problem in different ways and point to different reasons for the reasons why we're here. Point to different big worldwide trends as for the state that we're in. I don't want to romanticize factory culture, and I know enough about blue collar work that I think it's kind of silly and romantic to over sentimentalize it, but it did provide a living to a lot of houses. That's the foundation that the modern wealthy affluent United States stands on.
I think that's true. And I think there was a time when that was normal. I mean, I can remember, I was, you know, talking with a friend that I grew up with. We can remember standing there and watching the shift changes where, you know, an army of people would walk across the bridge into Ray, a city you know well, Holyoke. They would walk from my hometown of Chicopee. They'd go to the paper mills in Holyoke. And at the end of the day, you'd see all the same people coming across the bridge. You know, that at some point that's not sustainable. You're not going to make paper in Western Massachusetts forever. You're not going to mine coal forever. And I think part of what's going on is that some of this is just the jarring change that happens when there's a large technological and cultural shift, and people who are uncomfortable, and understandably so, to say, you know, I had a life that I understood and it had rules and an environment in which I was comfortable. And when that changes, they look for somebody to blame. But when you talk about the situation we're in, that's where I think Ian and I always come back to, what exactly is that situation? What is it in your life that is going, you know, again, if you live in Appalachia, you don't have access to healthcare, you're a middle-class person who's been put out of a job somewhere in your 40s or 50s, and you're having trouble finding another job in the same town. That's, you know, we can all empathize with that problem. The question is, for the people that are going to rallies or rioting in the streets of Paris or voting for, you know, anti-Semitic nationalists in Poland or electing comedians in Italy, it always comes down to, what is this situation that you're, you know, what's going on in a world full of, you know, miracles that you hate so much that you want to change? And I think some of it really is just an unquenchable and irresolvable nostalgia for the past, a romanticized past that doesn't really exist.
I think that there's truth to that. And certainly Make America Great Again and Ben Shapiro and all of these guys talking about how there was this wonderful mythic time. And whenever you ask them when that time was, they aren't able to actually tell you. So sure, there are charlatans politically out there that are taking advantage of those sorts of nativist messages. But Ray, you mentioned the fact that depending on who you are and where you are, your bogeyman is going to be different. And that's really true around the world, right? So in Germany, the average worker and member of the middle class feels pretty good about what the state is providing them economically, but they're really angry about the immigration. They're really angry about all these Muslims coming in that they feel aren't educated, aren't going to get good jobs, don't integrate, and even are a security threat, right? In Mexico and Brazil, you don't have the anti-globalization sentiment. They are very, I mean, Lopez Obrador won, and he's very much in favor of the new NAFTA, and that's because the middle and working class in Mexico felt like they did well on the back of NAFTA, and they did, as opposed to American working class who felt like they lost some jobs back in the 70s and 80s. We haven't talked at all about the failed wars, Iraq and Afghanistan. The United States sent so many people, most of them poor, enlisted men and women, and they gave the ultimate sacrifice. They came back, they weren't heroes, the wars failed, and the Veterans Administration wasn't really there for them. So, I mean, definitely there are different bogeymen, and while there's overlap and shading and weightings, there's lots of reasons why people are going to feel angry about their specific set of villains. But I do think there are two big things that are changing in one direction. One of them we've already identified, and that's social media technology that's suddenly weaponizing that anger. It's making everyone that has some level of grievance really aware of it and sticking them in the maw of all of these people that will take advantage of that anger for their own political purposes. That's what's happening in Twitter.
Definitely agree on that. Definitely.
No question. The second big thing that's happening is that technology is changing the workforce, and it's changing the relationship between labor and capital. And people that used to drive for UPS that had full benefits and the potential of a long career and that they could retire from with a pension, and they had insurance with the cars that were owned by the company, now they're driving for Amazon Prime, and they're workers like in the gig economy, and they don't have the benefits, and the quality of that work has objectively gone down. And it's not just that these people are uncomfortable with technological change, it's also that a lot of their livelihoods no longer have the opportunity that they did 20, 30, 40 years ago. And with automation and with robotics and with the artificial intelligence revolution that elites call the fourth industrial revolution, but a lot of workers might well call the post-industrial revolution, because there isn't necessarily space for them. And those two big technological drivers are really changing things.
We've been hearing from Tom Nichols of the Navy War College and Ian Bremmer of the Eurasia Group. Their focus is on the citizens' role in rebuilding the social contract between the government and the governed. After the break, join us for the second half of our conversation, moderated by Ray Suarez. You're listening to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. It's produced in association with KQED Public Radio and the Aspen Institute. I'm Jane Wales, your host. We're hearing from Tom Nichols. He's a professor at the Naval War College and author of the book, The Death of Expertise. Joining him is Ian Bremmer. He's president and founder of the Eurasia Group and of G-Zero Media. Moderating the program is my co-host, Ray Suarez. To hear this program or any other World Affairs program, you can download our podcasts on our iTunes channel or wherever you get your podcasts. Search for World Affairs. That's one word. And now back to our program.
If both of you are looking at the world as it is, and Ian has written that there's little good reason to expect a dramatic narrowing of inequality in the United States anytime soon. Tom, you've said publicly that in the longer term, you're worried about the end of the republic. So, I mean, neither of you are very sanguine about our prospects. But going forward, what do you do to get us back on track, and not just us in the United States, but in a lot of places where this disaffection is being felt? How do you get us back on track, get citizens back in the game, and have a sort of healthy relationship or proportionality between expectations and promises?
One thing I'd say is that this isn't going to get better because, and this is related to Ian's point, it's not going to get better because people don't want to forego the benefits of the things that are undermining that traditional way of life. It's true. You know, Amazon is going to put a lot of people that used to be UPS drivers out of work. But Nobody thinks about that when they order something from Amazon Prime. They're not going to go without it. So, you know, this is kind of like the argument we used to have about televisions 30 years ago, where people would say, we don't make American televisions anymore. Well, if you want two big screen TVs in your house, you're going to have to pay the Chinese for it. And unless you're willing to forego that and pay an American worker, and nobody is. I mean, that ship has sailed. That debate is over. And so I think one of the things, and I don't know how this happens, but I think there has to be some courage in political leadership to talk back to the public and say, look, one of the things I worry about is technocracy taking over and simply administering the state for the good of the masses without their consent, because I think that's one of the ways democracy dies. But if people are not going to be involved, if they are not going to inform themselves, if they can't find North Korea on a map, if they don't understand the three branches of government, which 50% of the American public cannot name the three branches of government, then you are by default handing power to those interests with money that I agree with Ian are far too powerful, far too woven in to the government. But I would argue that they are not wresting power away from the masses. The masses are handing it to them by default. And so unless somebody says, look, we need to have more public involvement, you need to spend less time on social media. I agree with Ian about this completely, that social media is a real danger, even though, you know, I'm one of the offenders, I guess. And to challenge the public to recover a certain amount of stoicism and on understanding that life doesn't always go the way you want it to go, especially if you want it to be surrounded by the conveniences that you will pay other countries to provide to you. You can't have it both. You can't have it every single way. And I think that, you know, it's the public has called out the elites. I think that's fair. I think that's, you know, that's what democracy is about. It's time for the elites and the leaders to step up and say, we have a few issues we want to raise with you, too. And we can't go on this way. We can't keep trying to answer the mail. The example I always use is we can't fix a problem if you want us to repeal Obamacare but keep the Affordable Care Act at the same time. At some point, these messages become so confused and so ignorant that we simply start ignoring you, which I think is already happening, which is part of this rage. So I think at some point the elites have to talk back to the masses and talk to them like adults instead of trying to coddle them like angry children.
Ian Bremmer?
Yeah. And at a time when we have this level of inequality, I am unprepared to say that the masses are 50% responsible for the situation that they're in. I think that actually a big part of the solution is going to have to be redistributive. I mean, with this level of inequality, you're going to have to increase taxation. You're going to have to actually take money from corporations and force them to invest in things they otherwise are not investing in. That is a reasonable response, but it can't be just that, because the system is not evolving to deal with new realities. And a lot of that is not going to come from the federal government. It's going to have to come from entrepreneurs and CEOs and mayors and governors. And what I mean here is if the workforce is going to look completely different, if it's going to be much more flexible, look much more like a gig economy, we're going to have regulations that get the data for who is in the gig economy, treat these people as real workers, make it easier for companies to hire and fire, but also ensure that social safety nets, arbitration, and a whole slew of benefits accrue to very different kind of workers than we had before. They're also going to have universal lifetime education. It's not just going to be. I mean, the vocational model from Germany, which we thought 10 years ago was the best model in the world, really isn't, because you can't set people up for 15, 20 years of schooling for one job that isn't going to exist in 10 or 20 years. You're going to have to be much more flexible, use AI, use distance learning, get people, younger people, that at once they're on the job to continue to be trained. And we're going to have to put the systems together for that. Now, I think that there are lots of examples in the United States and in Europe today with individual CEOs, entrepreneurs, philanthropists that are already trying small-scale experiments to do precisely these things. but they're small scale. It's like talking about building a solar industry 30 or 40 years ago. We don't know yet to deal with climate change. We don't yet know which of these are going to work sufficiently to become scalable and implementable as policy. So what we need now, and I think one of the reasons why Tom and I are both not very optimistic in the near term, is because you're going to have a period of experimentation so we learn what, I mean, this is a problem that has not really been even identified, never mind addressed, over the last 10, 20 years. In 2009, we had the Occupy Wall Street movement. Then it went away. Nobody did a damn thing. So now we're finally having these conversations in a big way, and we're going to have them in a big way in the 2020 election too. And I think, I hope that that leads a lot more Americans with the capacity to experiment to actually start putting these experiments in play, so that next time we have this conversation, we'll say, hey, we actually have some good experiences with some things that maybe we could use some public money to actually roll out and scale.
Tom, if you're in the Maidan in Kiev and saying that the government of the day has to go, if you are setting yourself on fire in Sidi Bou Said, just outside Tunis in Tunisia, and inadvertently setting off the Arab Spring, a lot of these people would agree on what they hate, but they don't really agree on what they want, what they like, or what they're going to do. Can you build any kind of coherent movement, either nationally or transnationally, out of sharing things that you're against? Do you have to be for something?
Yeah, I think it's tough to talk about this in a comparative context, because the triggers of the Arab Spring or the Maidan, I mean, the post-Soviet space has its own problems with the depletion of social capital that came after 70 years of Soviet misrule. I think in Western Europe and the United States, what we're seeing is the decline of a civic culture, of civic virtue, because people have become, at all levels of society, and I think this is where I will cast a pox on all their houses. People have become more selfish, more narcissistic, more self-interested. We really don't think about what's best in terms of the community. I mean, I agree with Ian. I love the idea of that he talks about local and regional experimentation. I'm constantly telling people to remember that they have local businessmen, mayors, governors, that there's a whole bunch of people until you start getting all the way to the president of the United States. But I also don't think that any of this will work, because the one thing we haven't talked about, I don't think any of this works until we recover at least some sense of our personal virtue, until we stop having a lot of out-of-wedlock births, until we stop having, these same young men who claim to be so desperate kind of wandering through multiple relationships and deferring marriage, that we have, you know, children who don't detach from their parents, or parents who try to keep their children close because they're afraid of losing them from the hometown. I mean, there's a lot of social dysfunction here that redistribution, by the way, I give Ian all the credit in the world for saying the word that a lot of political leaders won't say, which is redistribution. I think some of that's just going to have to happen. You can't have this much money sitting at the top of the pyramid, not because of social resentment. That to me is a lesser problem than that. It simply starves out other projects for oxygen. You're going to have to build airports and bridges and things like that. But I don't think that redistribution solves the basic problem of a society that has become at its foundation fundamentally narcissistic and unvirtuous at every level. And until we confront that in ourselves, we're just sticking Band-Aids on things, in my view.
Ian, it sounds like you two guys are just identifying different places on the same continuum. Because if we took your prescription about re-energizing localism, being open to experimentation, wouldn't we work civic muscles? Wouldn't we create some of the civic virtue that Tom is yearning for?
Yes, we certainly would. And again, I think we agree on far more than we disagree. And from my perspective, you have to start top down, because there is so much disillusionment and there is so much concentration of wealth. But I fully agree that we've lacked, we've lost a lot of the sense of what makes America American. And the greatest generation after World War II, you know, even the working class did not have that problem. Growing up, when I watched, you know, sort of Schoolhouse Rock, and I learned, you know, the preamble for the Declaration of Independence to song, I mean, all the working class kids in my school knew that, and we kind of knew what it stood for. We knew what the Statue of Liberty stood for, and we need to re-engage in values and virtue.
Tom Nichols, one of the things that the angry people have in common is that they, in many cases, regard the elites as having not indifference to them, but actual malign intent, gleefully selling them mortgages that blew up 5 and 6 and 10 years down the road, selling them junky products, selling them on ideas about trade and the movement of people around the globe that they now suspect those people knew were lies. How do you reclaim some of that power so that you walk into this space a little bit more confident that you know what you're talking about and you can't be lied to as easily?
I think there are multiple pieces to that. One is, yes, the worst enemy of a huckster or a con man is an educated person. And one thing that all professional con men agree is you cannot con an honest person. That the con men of the great, you know, the era of the sting and the big schemes of the 1920s and 30s, the one thing all those guys agreed on is that their worst enemy was someone who was honest, because then they couldn't take advantage of their inherent character flaws to con them and make them into marks. And I think that's part of the conversation we're not having here, that, yes, you know, the mortgage crisis, you know, that was full of all of these wifty instruments that were created by bankers. I don't really think created by elites. They were created by your neighbors. They were created by people who decided to become mortgage brokers overnight to fleece you out of your money. But it also required you to believe that you could really afford a $500,000 house, you know, while being a part-time laborer, and that you want that was something you wanted. Again, I think so much of the populist rallying cry ends up translating back to stop giving me what I want. And so I think, yes, the educated consumer, the people who reengage, I think Ian has made me warm and nostalgic for the days of Schoolhouse Rock. But I also think that the regulatory environment needs to change. I mean, I really do think, on this, Ian and I agree completely, that people with a lot of money simply walk around blowing up regulations that are inconvenient to them. And I don't think that we should continue being able to do that. I think that, you know, that there has to be a stronger regulatory hand. We saw that after the mortgage crisis. Although, again, you know, what's happening after the mortgage crisis? People are going back to record amounts of consumer debt. They're defaulting on their car loans. There are several pieces to this.
I want to stop well short of blaming the victim. But was there a certain acquiescence, first Ian, then Tom, that during the immediate era right after the fall of the Berlin Wall, that there was a reassurance from big voices in the culture, you let us do our thing and you'll be in for a taste, so don't worry. That acquiescence, that whatever was going on in the top 1% of the top 1%, I was going to get a piece of the action, so go ahead and do your thing. Deregulate, make friction-free capitalism, move stuff around the world with the fantasy that people won't move around as well, but just give me a taste and I'm okay. Can you unspool that acquiescence in a way that puts citizen oomph, to use the technical term, back in the game as a factor?
I think it's a great question. And I mean, that trickle down promise that never quite made it right. But yes, a lot of people believed in it. The problem is it didn't work. It actually got worse. And we've experienced this before in the United States. I mean, you know, Hoover, his initial response to the extraordinary economic inequality and the depredations of capitalism without a safety net was to say, let's empower the private sector more and the wealthy people, and philanthropy will take care of all of this. Well, you know what? It didn't. And as a consequence, FDR comes in and he builds the New Deal and he actually creates things that many would have derided as socialism at the time. And now we consider part of a proper functioning capitalist state that is well regulated with a government that cares and is responsible to its citizens. If we could do it then with a Great Depression, we can surely do it now with working class that is so much wealthier than it used to be, with so much more capacity and talent and knowledge and technology in our country today.
Tom Nichols?
I would add a word to what Ian said about people believed in it. I would add they wanted to believe in it. And I think that's part of the original sin of all of this after the 1990s is, yeah, there were elites making high-flying promises about globalization, many of which came true. I mean, you know, it's a really staggering statistic to realize that before deregulation in the 1970s, only about 15% of American adults had ever flown on a commercial airliner. Now it's, you know, like 90. It's in the high 80s and passing 90. Pretty much anybody who wants to fly can fly at will. Now, you know, that has costs. That has externalities to it. And I think the problem is that the conversation we need to have, and this is the question I started with when we began talking, is what is it you want? How do you want elites to change the world in a way that will make you less angry? And I'm not sure that's possible because I think people, and this goes back to the social media question, people are deriving a huge sense of their identity from being angry about things. It's almost like they will not let you take away their anger. During the 2016 election, I talked with someone who said, you know, what if the governments, the elites, are lying to us and unemployment is 40%? That candidate Trump is right, it's close to 40%. And I said, I swear to you on a stack of Bibles that unemployment is not 40% in the United States. And this person kind of paused and said, but what if I feel like it is? Well, at some point, that's where you have to turn to someone who says, I'm angry because I feel like unemployment is 40%. And you have to tell them to grow up. Stop getting your news from Facebook. Stop getting your news from apps. Take the time to watch a newscast and then turn the TV off or read a newspaper for a half an hour. And, you know, suddenly the excuses tumble out. I'm too busy. It's too boring. Everybody's a liar. To some extent, we're dealing with a populace internationally that has really become a bunch of anger junkies because it makes them feel like they have very fulfilled lives. This is what takes the place of religion or family or community ties. And it becomes, you know, I am to be angry is to exist. And those resentments, you know, nurture me. And I think at some point, all of the reforms that Ian's talking about, I would love to work with Ian on all those things because I don't think those are liberal or conservative answers. I think those are solid answers that, you know, people of good will should work on across the board. But I don't know how to, I think it has to be accompanied by telling people to start acting like adults and to start letting go of, you know, really sustaining myths that keep them continually angry about things that are not true.
Well, let me close with both of you by talking about voting, the most direct and available form of citizen action. One big change in the last 25 years is that far more people now elect their governments. The elections are sometimes flawed, the candidates are certainly often flawed, but more people can vote in more places and choose governments than was true ever in the history of the world. Are we underplaying the importance of simple citizen participation and the pressure that can put in the pipe? And does it point a way forward, or one of the ways forward, as we look prospectively on taking some of this anger addiction that Tom just described out of the equation? Ian?
More people live in democracies today than 25 years ago, but more of those democracies are weaker and more closed democracies and have more elements of authoritarianism than they did 25 years ago. So I don't know how optimistic you want to be on that one. Also, if you look at the amount of economic heft of authoritarian regimes compared to democracies, I mean, that's a dramatic change. In the next 10 years, the world's largest economy is going to be authoritarian, not democratic. And the impact that has in aligning other countries and people towards a successful model that doesn't allow for open participation of its citizens is a real problem. But leaving aside how what the trajectory of the globe looks like on all of this, there's no question in my mind that a system that allows people to participate in it and express their voice is one that has more capacity to fix these problems. And I do believe that in the United States, I mean, Trump is part of the solution. He's part of the solution because he's forced an awful lot of people to say, oh my God, how did we live in a country that got to the point that someone like that would be elected? You can't blame Trump for that. You have to say, what is it about the system that got these people this angry? And this is forcing people like the three of us to spend a lot of our time where 10, 20 years ago, we would have been writing and thinking about other things. Now we're addressing this, and we're going to see this front and center in the 2020 campaign. And maybe it means Biden's not a slam dunk, by the way, for the Democratic nomination, which is going to be a very interesting question.
Tom Nichols, take us home.
Yeah, when it comes to the rise of democracy, I was much happier about that 25 years ago. Now, there are more people living in democracies, but to steal a phrase, do not congratulate, because a lot of these are illiberal democracies. They're majoritarian. They're almost verging on authoritarian majority states of the kind that our founding fathers specifically designed a constitution to prevent. And so I think, you know, that there's a real danger there that democracy could become mobocracy. I think here in the United States, I think Ian's point is really well taken, that in some strange way, Trump has actually motivated people to get off their butts. And yet, again, you know, the adult conversation we need to have. There are still people who are convinced that Trump stole the election because the Russians did. The Russians attacked us. I've written about this. I'm a hardliner on the whole Russia case. But, you know, my answer to this is, if you get your news from Facebook, you are going to be manipulated by foreign actors. And the answer to that is not to get your news from Facebook. Even with that sense of urgency, even in the most contested election of my lifetime, only 6 out of 10 people voted. In the 2018 midterm elections, we celebrated because the youth vote jumped. It doubled to something like a record 36%. Now, that tells you something. When people are complaining about how powerless they feel and how terrible things are and how this happened, and yet the most able group of people, the people that could pretty much run the country tomorrow if they showed up for an election, were celebrating that they actually got their turnout up to 36%. That's disgraceful. And I'm hoping that will change, because then that does force us all into a more civic conversation with each other when we go to the election booth, instead of not showing up and just complaining about how awful everything is. So if there's a certain amount of hope there, it may well be that this crisis is forcing us out of our cocoons. But I, like Ian, I'm somewhat pessimistic, but I guess I'll end by saying I lived through the great wave of post-communist democratization, and I don't want to believe that's over. So I'm going to maintain my sense of optimism for now.
Ian Bremmer, author of Us Versus Them, The Failure of Globalism, thanks a lot for joining us.
Very happy to.
And Tom Nichols, author of The Death of Expertise. Great to have you with us.
Thanks for having me, Ray.
You've been listening to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. Ours is a nonprofit membership organization. We're dedicated to engaging the public in conversations that matter. Visit us at worldaffairs.org. This program featured Tom Nichols. He's a professor at the Naval War College, and he's the author of the book, The Death of Expertise. He's joined by Ian Bremmer, president and founder of the Eurasia Group and of G-Zero Media. This program was moderated by my co-host, Ray Suarez.
It's no longer going to be acceptable to make a killing on your investments while the people that work for those companies don't make a living wage. People will look back on that in the history books as a moral blind spot.
Tune in next week for part two of this special series on rebuilding the social contract. We'll explore the role of the business sector, from small firms to large corporations. They're creating jobs, they're maximizing profits, but do they play a larger social role, one of purpose as well as profit? Our technical supervisor is Jim Bennett. Our researcher is Claire McMahon. Our producer is Jared Sport, and our executive producer is Laura Beatty. World Affairs is produced in association with KQED Public Radio and the Aspen Institute. I'm Jane Wales. Thank you for joining us.